Welcome to For the Love of Conversation, the podcast that grew out of 3 Minute Storyteller, where we believe conversations connect us and social change begins with the stories we tell. At 3 Minute Storyteller, we share digital stories, video snippets of intimate, messy, expansive conversations with a wildly eclectic bunch of artists, scientists, leaders of all stripes, all who are legendary change agents. Some you may know, and hopefully many you don't. This podcast is the opportunity to bring you into the full conversation. I'm Shannon Mannon, along with my husband Mike and our VW bus Scarlett, who we've outfitted into an awesome mobile storytelling unit. We invite you into the full conversation with us. We're so glad you're along for the ride. This week's storyteller is Dr. Amanda Kemp. Her new book, Say the Wrong Thing, Stories and Strategies for Racial Justice and Authentic Community, is reminiscent of Alice Walker's Essays of Social Justice, Anything We Love Can Be Saved. Amanda's vibrant reflections offer a way through the pain of racism to the healing work our world demands of us. Poet, performer, playwright, founder of the Theater of Transformation, Amanda conducts racial justice, art, and academic residencies at universities throughout the U.S. with her distinct brand of performance lecture. Most days, though, she simply calls herself a mentor. Our conversation ranges from the challenges of cultivating abundance after a childhood in the foster care system where she was often hungry, to the powerful, courageous letter her teenage son Gabe wrote to her describing his terror and triggers in growing up young and Black in America. She shares their letter exchange and how its teachings are still unfolding for her. It's an instructive glimpse into the heart of our young Black men that's urgent to hear and vital to understand. Sitting down with Amanda is so graceful and easy that what you'll hear in the beginning was just our initial chatter before the interview officially began. But since the wisdom just sort of spills out of this brilliant woman, we decided to include it.
And in fact, that older generation, the 60s, 70s yeah. people,
yes.
they're like, wait, European Americans, they're like, wait, you, when I was involved, we were like trying to say, look, don't look at the color of the skin, and we're trying to really train people to not see color, you know what I mean? Absolutely. This is where they're coming from, and for right. them, this was like
a total
cutting edge,
right?
Right, and now I'd be saying, no.
Turns out that's
switch out that thing, you know? Yeah. That's really not equity. Yeah. That's just asking us to act white.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah,
that's very disruptive. Mm. That's really disruptive for them.
But confusing, I'm sure. Because could you remember yeah. the pen that they're. Yeah, like they thought that that was, it's like it changed so much in their one generation,
yes.
one lifetime. So
yes.
for them to be like, sweet.
Yeah.
But to keep trying is
yes.
encouraging.
And I think there's a lot of hurt in that group, that white age group. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of hurt because they felt pushed out when civil rights became Black power.
Yeah.
Their role of how do I be a good person, how do I be in solidarity, how do I be a good American, for them all of a sudden they didn't see a role for themselves. Mm-hmm. And also because they were being redirected, and most people I think couldn't take this on, they were being redirected to go and work inside the European American community. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
They just kind of died out, it feels like.
Yeah, but without much support.
Yeah.
And so the people just sort of like, so women, actors went into the women's movement, or yeah. the predominantly white women's movement. They took that energy there,
yes.
you know what I mean? And then more radical people went into leftist organizations. Hmm. See what I'm saying?
Totally.
But then you have this group of women who didn't go into women's movements, who didn't go left, who just kind of got a little bit confused and felt left out and still were liberal, but have hurt. And I run into people. I run into people with this in my workshop. Sometimes they'll call me up and they'll be honest and they'll say, why can't we all just be people? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Why can't we all just be people? I mean, when I was involved in the 60s, I went down for Freedom Summer. Mm-hmm. You know, some people put their bodies on the line and they're like, you know, hurting and resentful and confused. There's a lot of very confused older European Americans. Like you said, things shifted and they didn't shift, or they didn't have the support to look at themselves.
But that's interesting that you're holding space for then all of that pain.
Yeah.
I don't think about white pain in that regard. That's new to me. I hadn't thought of that generation, and yes. That's helpful.
Yes.
It's helpful because the wanting and the longing is yes. still there, and it can still be activated and tapped into.
Yes.
And you know, once that, like, I'm sure, you know, you tenderly sort of help them through that pain.
Well,
and then
there's resistance.
It has calcified.
Yes.
Like scar tissue.
There's resistance. Yeah. You know? Mm. So it's like, are they willing? And some people, it's like the investment in being a good person is so deep. Like, I'm a good person. Mm-hmm. It's so deep that, so the whole conversation about white privilege, and they just, it still feels to them like you're saying they're like Bull Connor, mm-hmm. you know, or like you haven't suffered. Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I actually think, I'm not going to do this, but I actually think those people could use a performative process. Like if I was to do like storytelling, like they really need people to listen to their story, mm-hmm. kind of enact their story, show their mm-hmm. confusion, mm-hmm. like help them be vulnerable with it. And I've always known that the way to get to people's heart is through art. The quickest way to the heart is through art. Not through, let me run down the history for you, mm-hmm. you know?
I love that you just said that, because one of the first, well, I want to get to that. Let me start this.
Yeah.
I want to just go back to your growing up in the foster care system, mm-hmm. and anything you want to talk about your earliest, mm-hmm. I want to say trauma, but also you talk about, you've written about how you've really experienced the extremes of, wealth and mm. privilege on one hand in your boarding school, and then mm. also the extremes of poverty and all of that
right.
in the Bronx. So I just want to know a little bit about the beginning, however you're comfortable talking mm. about that, mm. and if there was any spiritual dimension mm. to your upbringing
yeah.
that you have a memory of, mm. whatever that means to you.
Right. So I grew up thoroughly Christian. And by that, I mean Christian, I should probably say Black Christian. And by that, what I mean is that just in the name of Jesus, I realized like how we say it and the power of the name, and we have songs. Jesus, you know, every day, your name is the same. You know what I mean? It's just like, you know, people say, you know, you get, it's a mantra,
yeah.
right? So we have a lot of, there's a lot of energy in that. Even if, and right now, I don't consider myself a Christian, but I can't, but I have this whole heritage. And it's all seeped inside of me. So I wanted to say that because one of my earliest memories, so I grew up, my mother was addicted to heroin. I knew she was addicted. There were drugs problems. And my father, who turned out to be not my biological father, but I had no idea, it was an abusive relationship. And so my mom to me represented good and he represented evil. I was gonna put it like that. And soft, nurturing, you know, physical, scary, hurting, harmful person, right? Powerful, though. Not powerful. So, unfortunately, that's the dichotomy that I was at a very early age was what I was living with. Mm-hmm. Probably from maybe 4 to 6 or 3 to 6, something like that. Super powerful, like watching violence happen, mm-hmm. you know? And seeing it, the feminine mm-hmm. and the masculine in that mm-hmm. way, right? And these are two black people. Mm-hmm. But I never didn't believe in God. That's what I mean, culturally. It's just part of what it was, right? And so one of my questions was, as a kid, was how powerful is God if evil keeps overwhelming or a bad guy keeps overwhelming good mom? You know, how powerful is God? And why does God let this happen? So these are my early spiritual wonderings, you know? And when we went into foster care, which I did gleefully, I should say, I felt rescued. I felt like a prayer had been answered because mm-hmm. we were neglected mm-hmm. physically, emotionally, physically abused. I mean, there was so much going on there. Mm-hmm. So we needed to be rescued. And in my opinion, but this question of how do you be good and powerful stayed with me, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. because of this early imprinting and because of, you know, looking at the world around me, I just knew it was better than what I came from, because what I came from was complete neglect. So we moved up, and for us moving up was moving into the projects, you know, into a family where, you know, somebody was home every day and consistency and there was food every day. So we definitely had improved. And I started to recognize in the environment that it was harsh and not safe. I didn't feel safe. So I have a lot of questions for God, a lot of asking. Mm-hmm. And so for me, when I talk about Dr. King being an early like elder for me, what I mean is that he seemed to put power and good in the same space. Mm-hmm. Possibility, strength, and goodness could be in the same space, you know? Mm-hmm. And besides, it wasn't hard to like him because, you know, he was well-liked. It wasn't like I was revolutionary in my family. That was something, you know, just accepted. You know, mm-hmm. he had his picture up there with some palms around him. He was like a little angel mm-hmm. in a way.
Yeah.
So I guess that for me, though, maybe that early imprinting with watching bad overcome good, it left me with a heart for the underdog. It left me with a heart for the underdog. So, and that stays with me. You know, I'm looking for how to make it right. I'm looking for how to empower. But used to be saving, like I want to be saved, you know, and over the course of my life, it's like, how do we empower? How do I empower myself? And I think that's one of the things that distinguishes me as a racial justice and mindfulness mentor, is I'm looking for how do I empower? How do I empower myself? How do I reclaim my power? And that's my responsibility. So it's not looking for the system or other people, specifically European Americans, to stop being bad or ignorant or whatever they're being. I'm looking for over here, how do I reclaim, activate my power, remember my power? One of the things that they say when you're in a family dynamic where there's an abusive male, you know what they say? Strengthen the mother. You want to change that? Strengthen the mother. And that has stayed with me. You know, that person has to find her power again so that she can protect. And And I guess, you know, when I think about my work and how it's evolving, I feel like helping women of color reconnect to our power is really important. And that's the journey I'm in right now, because now I'm remarried and I'm in an interracial family, and you know, I have the mother role, you know, for kids I gave birth to who are Black, and for kids who I did not give birth to who are definitely European American, right? And so strengthening the mother, you know, like, it's a challenge. This really, you asked me about living the extremes, like having grown up, you know, in the projects, you know, in low income community, having, and before that, having grown up hungry, you know, to then going into a elite boarding school for girls, you know, that is truly extreme. And sometimes I look back at it and I was like, God, I feel like you gave me this super extreme experience for a reason. You know what I mean? There's something, like, there's something here, right? Mm-hmm. So that probably has something to do with my capacity to bridge and to see the humanity, you know, in people with like class and race privilege or and owning class. I mean, you know, all that kind of stuff, because I've had relationships, close relationships, in a variety of places.
Right, because your work, you know, as to our earlier conversation, like it's you see the humanity and the suffering in everyone. It's not unique
right.
to one population
right.
that we might think. There's right. there's a real crisis in,
yeah.
in all of us.
Yeah.
Especially now.
Yeah.
The loneliness and the human condition.
Yes. And you know, I was in a 12-step program for over 10 years mm-hmm. in this community, and it was predominantly white, the 12-step rooms I was in. And so I heard suffering, day in, day out, people suffering. So it's not like I think that white skin privilege cancels suffering, you know, or equals liberation.
Not only does whiteness not inoculate you from suffering, but as if all of our liberation wasn't bound up with each other's.
What?
As if all of our liberation wasn't bound
right.
up with each other.
Right.
So even if it did,
right.
even if it could,
right.
it never could.
Right. Because the whole concept of whiteness is to create suffering.
Right.
You
right.
know? It is to actually produce suffering.
Absolutely.
And separation. So, which is why I like to talk about people as being European American, because I think that that's more of an ethnic relationship, more closely related to biology than to an identity that was purposely created to create suffering and separation, and then justify, you know, dismembering the human family. The only reason to create white is to dismember. To say there's no family here.
So I when I kind of sat back to look at your life from what I could understand, I just kept seeing this journey to wholeness.
Mm-hmm.
And like the world might have tried to break you apart in pieces to understand you better, fit her in this box here, and this part of her here, and this part of slicing and dicing you. And it felt like you've been like just kind of pushing through to reclaim your wholeness. And what I've seen in your work is that it's both very much an inner journey
mm-hmm.
personally to mm-hmm. you, and it's very reflected in your outer what you put out in your art mm-hmm. and your work in alignment with each other. And I loved that about like kind of like seeing you evolve over time. One of the things I wanted to talk to you about, I guess, is a grounding in this moment, is to talk about the tribe of the heart mm-hmm. community, this intentional community, what that is and why you created it, and also your book. And to talk about the Say the Wrong Thing, like why that began and why you felt like that was an important thing to say. So
it's so interesting you mentioned the tribe of the heart, because I think it was around 2015 that I started to articulate that that's what I wanted to create. And that vision has, I haven't really pushed that out. Like, that baby is not born. Mm-hmm. That baby is still gestating. And, but the whole impulse behind it was that we are coming into more and more polarized times. So this was before Trump, this was before his candidacy. But I was feeling like yes. we were coming into times that were going to cause us to separate. Yes. And I had a friend who said something like, I will die on the hill of, it's like the thing that you're not going to let go of. And I was like, so this is for people who are willing to die on the hill of oneness, who aren't going to sacrifice, who aren't going to relinquish oneness, you know? Mm-hmm. And what's so hard about that is holding on to that in the face of the increasing polarization, with the increasing sense of harm and isolation. Let me try to tell you when I be specific. So I was just having a conversation with a woman of color who's involved with diversity work in her school, right? A leader. Quote, I feel so isolated, Amanda, end quote. Talking to someone who's European American, and she said, I feel so isolated. You know what I mean? Change makers, both of these people change in different spaces. And it struck me that when I heard her say that, when the woman of color said it, I could totally get it, because I was like, I've been in your shoes, you know, shifting an institution, one of very few, blah, 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 blah. When she said it, it wasn't that I hadn't heard it before, but I heard it so close to the woman of color saying it, that I recognized, wow, the way the system works is it does have us feel isolated. It has us feel so separate from each other, you know? So to hold on to the hill of oneness in the midst of cultivating justice and compassion. It's like to stand with your feet in both spaces, justice and compassion. It is hard. It is uncommon. You know, it requires wisdom and a big heart and like a spiritual grounding and, you know, all that stuff from your ancestors. It just cannot be done with the ego or the mind, because it doesn't make sense to hold on to it from that perspective. So you gotta call on everybody to help you hold on to that. Meaning, you know, your European American ancestors, you gotta call on your men, male identify, you need it all to hold on to that. I'm realizing this, speaking this to you. So without having access to all of them, this tribe, we'll feel isolated. We will feel isolated.
Yeah.
And so for me, it's almost like I'm going on retreat in 4 days. And I think this is the piece for me to take into the retreat. Mm-hmm. It's this tribe of the heart, you know. Where does it go? What do I need? You know, because right now I feel kind of resigned or beat down, you know. And this is where they say, you know, asleep with the self-care 14-day thing. I think the universe is really telling me you gotta restock, re-nourish, reconnect, you know, to hold this and to remember why you held it in the first place. So I'm still working it out. You asked me about the tribe of heart, what is it? Well, I'm still working it out. So, but it is that. It's people who want to stand for both of those things and be in spiritual community with each other. I mean, I had the whole vision of like people coming together physically, but also, you know, virtually, but physically, the beach, lots of light, getting that nourishment, that feeding of the heart, that regrounding, that, yeah.
The pit crew. That's what I, my tribe of the heart is, I've had the same vision. And I just, but my metaphor, I love the tribe of the heart language way more, but I always call it the pit crew. Like, you know, you see NASCAR.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm not a NASCAR person, so I don't even know why.
Pit crew.
But, it, you know, you're around and you're around and you're around, and you need to, like a temple. It's a temple where you go and, like you would do in the biblical times, and you would get oiled and massaged and sent back out. But just that place that you go to go back. And it's very real. It's calling.
Yes.
I hear it too.
Yes. And it's very needed, right? Mm-hmm. You need the pit crew. Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting to me that you saw this coming. The people that I talked to, the real students of the human condition, because so many, there's no way. And then not to make it about Trump, this is something much bigger than any political candidate, but the ones that saw it coming weren't surprised.
No.
No. That's what you saw.
Yes. Yes.
You read the tea leaves. I don't know.
Well, I just felt it.
Yeah.
I just felt it. I'm a feeler. Mm-hmm. I felt it. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to say, I'm going to stand here and you know, Ruby Sales says, you can't coerce me into hating you. Mm-hmm. It's like, mm-hmm. I mean, when people take that self-determination, you know, I got me. That's powerful. And it needs to be nurtured, right? Because we get beat down and distracted and we get tired. Yeah.
So you wrote something, I'm going to just quote something that you wrote. You said, I have degrees and certifications in African and Afro-American students in African studies. I've taught Africana studies, classes on whiteness and post-colonialism. I've lived on the continent, organized Black students. I've built my identity around actively fighting for Black art, Black complexity, Black traditions, and Black intellectual history. And then you wanted to describe how you took Harvard's implicit bias test, which tests our unconscious racial bias, without a whole lot of thought. And you ended up with a score showing moderate preference for light skin relative to dark skin. And clearly this is a really big surprise and blow. And I guess what I love about that essay is you didn't put a bow on it. You didn't put it in a box and say, okay, I figured this out. You just left that despair hanging out there. And you brought up a lot of questions. So I was wondering if you could talk about that, your experience and how you, what that was like for you.
The experience of being with the question?
When you took that, what came up for you?
What happened?
Yeah.
Well, I felt shame. How could I come up with this score? Given what I do for a living. and I felt scared. And I also felt like I've got to write about this, because part of being with it is to write it down, and so it's not a secret. Mm-hmm. You know, my mom said, my mom came into my life for 3 years. Mm-hmm. So I last saw her when I was 6. I saw her again when I was 27. So, and then she died you know, 3 years later. So, but before she died, she had a big impact on me. And one of the things that she said was, your secrets keep you sick. And so anyway, I wanted to write about it. I wanted to write about it as a way to be of service. Kind of to tell on myself. Because one of the things in a 12-step room is you tell on yourself to be of service. You know, first service to you, to say it out loud so you're not hiding. But then it becomes, it's an of service thing. When you really share vulnerably, people feel served by you. Because you've just given them some truth, something for them to identify with. One of the problems with social media, I think, is that it's all about projecting this image of having it together. Always looking beautiful, always look like you have the happy family, you know, whatever. And so writing is a place for me to be vulnerable. And in the sharing of it, it doesn't feel so bad. It just doesn't feel so bad. And I can also, in the writing of it, I go through it and I say, okay. So I have to make a habit of affirming the dark brown. I took the color test. I didn't take the racial bias test. Oh, okay. And so I made a commitment to celebrate the dark brown. You know, to seeing that, to amplifying that, calling it beautiful, like that. Mm-hmm. So that's what that experience was like for me.
You know, I love those tests. It takes out of the personal. It's the air we breathe, it's the water we drink. And so I think there's real power in this scientific data that shows it's not a fault, it's not a bad person,
right?
A bad white person. Early in your career, you had sort of political leanings and going to South Africa and doing Black liberation work. To me, I think it feels like there's a certain legitimacy in changing the world from a political standpoint.
Yeah.
And, you know, if we want to be in social change, that's what we do. And I think you've written about your time in academia, getting your PhD. It sort of choked or hibernated your creative expression and your artistic side. And I've heard that from a number of people that when they were really deep in their academic work, they've really lost the creative self, which I think is really interesting and worth exploring. Maybe that's a different conversation. But I just want to know, you know, you obviously came back to art. So what was that whole journey like for you, and does that tension still exist in you today, assuming it was a tension that had to make you say being an artist is just as worthy as, you know, whatever, something else that's more culturally acceptable?
Right. Yeah, so my midlife crisis came when I was in my 40s, I think. But I know at a certain point, I was like, what am I trying to do with my life? You know, I had my PhD, I had two tenure track jobs, and I had left both of them by that time, because I had young kids, and I really wanted, unexpectedly, I was very interested in mothering. you know, who knew that I was very into, like, diet and just, like, creating this best environment and, I don't know, the whole human physical thing of mothering and the nesting, things that I was not like before. And so anyway, I had these two tenure track jobs in academia, and I had given them both up. And at a certain point, I had been invited to assist with directing some teenagers who were doing monologues in the voice of historical figures from Lancaster who had endured slavery or who had escaped slavery to live here. So, and I just started to see, oh, yeah, yeah, I forgot this joy. I forgot what this joy feels like. And I started to just to collaborate on the side, on the edges, in theater, which is what my training had been in. And all of a sudden I started saying, well, what's the thing I really love to do, even when it's hard? And it was theater, you know? The creation, the co-creation with people, the sharing. I'm an extrovert. So, you know, having people together, and now I would call it ceremony. You know, the energy, the teaching, the loving, the pain, the processing, the cleansing. So for me, that's all, that's theater. That's the kind of theater that, you know, I'm very, that I was committed to creating. And so at a certain point, after I left academia, was on a spiritual sabbatical, and I just started to voice to it. Theater for transformation, for the transformation of self, for the transformation of community and society. And the first articulation didn't have the word race in it. It was built on this idea of creating abundance and forgiveness through telling stories of enslaved people in places like New Jersey, New York, Philadelphia, where you don't think about slavery. So I wanted to tell it through the experiences of people who have been enslaved, Black people. But the purpose of the company was about creating abundance and forgiveness and new possibilities to not be chained by the past or to be chained by systems like racism. So creating this company was like coming out. It was like coming out of the closet. Like, yeah, I'm super smart, you know, and I like teaching and, you know, whatever. But I'm really an artist. And so declaring I'm an artist as an identity, that was new. And that didn't happen until my late 30s. But I took it on. And then in my 40s, developed it more. And the challenge was creating an organizational structure that would continue to support the art. And in the US, you know, what we have is this nonprofit kind of structure. And it's unfortunate for small art companies, because then you have to build the company or you build the art. And a lot of artists get diverted to building the company. And if you try to do both, you burn out. And I did both, and I burned.
So I want to talk about the letter exchange you had with your son, Gabe.
Yeah.
So that one is a tough one. We'll call him the spirit of Gabe. So can I read these words that he wrote to you when he describes his growing distress of seeing Black men beaten and killed? Gabe writes, I've been internalizing these messages for the last 4 years, and it's changing my body, it's changing my brain and my emotions. It's making me go into survival mode where I, as a human being, become an animal because that's what I'm constantly told I am and how I see people like me being treated. So, as a mom, getting those words, I can only imagine. And then, you know, you go on to, through a series of letters, respond to Gabe through your evolution of working through what the best response is. And, you know, what I saw you do is, you know, your natural, I think a mother's natural mama bear instinct is to keep her cubs safe no matter what. That's biologically woven into us. And for this Black son in the world, who's seen as dangerous, is elevated to such a different level than, you know, for example, what I would have to reckon with my own sons. So you ultimately saw that you needed to pull back on your safety as your lead foot and let him develop into his full power and full potency by activating yeah. himself on the front lines a little bit through the yeah. activism he wanted to do. Right. So I just was wondering if you could talk through that whole process and yeah. what you learned from doing all of that.
Yeah. First of all, that letter was a shock. Mm-hmm. I had no idea. I sent him away to school to protect him. Mm-hmm. I sent him to a Quaker school to protect him. So when I got that from him, I was shocked that he was feeling that way. And what he really wanted from me was to read it and just accept it, what he said. I responded, but what he really wanted, he didn't want my response. He wanted me to listen to him. And I share that letter when I give a talk, you know. I share excerpts from that letter because so often people in the room don't know that, you know. They don't have someone close to them who is a young black male. So they don't know. I didn't know until he wrote me that. I really didn't know. This is my protected, grown-up, middle class, in a boarding school environment. I mean, you know, really. I had no idea. I also, when he wrote that, you didn't read the part that he wrote later. He wrote about not being in control of his body. And when you feel like you're prey and there's a predator after you, you're just on survival instinct and you just move. And it reminded me how when I was in college, one of my friends in my dorm, and she said, the police came after him and he just started running. I said, why did he run? She said, I asked him and he said he didn't know. So they arrested him for resisting arrest. But why were they arresting him to begin with? They don't have to have a reason. And then he had to sign something so that he wouldn't somehow incriminate them to get out. And I never forgot that. I just never forgot that, wow, that this thing happened and he just got triggered into running. And you know, there are all these stories about black boys running, you know, and then for my son to tell me, and it made me think about Baltimore and, you know, LA, you know, when you have these events that spark violence, when people start to blow, to set fire to things or turn cars over. Because what he said in that letter was, he says, sometimes I don't have control of my body. I mean, I'm just like, things are happening. It's like the nervous system has just taken over. I felt like it was like insight into what happens, you know? And so all this from my 16-year-old. And and the other thing is that my 16-year-old boy is a 16-year-old black boy growing up now, and I am, and at the time, you know, I was a woman in my late 40s, right? But the whole peace and love conversation wasn't hitting him, wasn't connecting with him. Like he told me, really young, he told me, I'm not like you, mommy. I was like, what do you mean? This is like early. He's like, I'm not into all that peace, you know? And then if you read his essay, what he's talking about is like, he's seeing black men, he said, some guy being kicked like a football. Like he doesn't matter. You know, and so a conversation about peace or compassion doesn't really make sense to him. So what I'm saying to you is that that letter keeps teaching me, it's resonating with me, you know, about the disjuncture between, you know, me and how I feel, what really resonates is so true with me and what does not resonate with him. And I think what's really important, honestly, is for that voice to be really, really appreciated. Like, for him to feel like, I really, really, really am sorry. Or I really, really, somehow, to speak from the heart to him, and by him I mean this whole grouping, that could have an impact. But we've got to listen to them. You know, we really, and we've got to create forms for them. Meaning, again, this age grouping, these teenage, young Black men, to be able to speak their collective, their individual experience and hear their collective thing, and from the inside of supporting it, challenging it. Because you are not an animal, no matter what somebody says about you, you know, and you're in charge of your nervous system. No matter what, you know, has happened prior to this, how can we help you to be in charge of your nervous system? Do you see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So the conversation has to turn to empowerment. But before we go there, you should, or you shouldn't, you know, there's nothing for them in that. Nothing for them in that. And I feel like there's a real disconnect between like the NAACPs of the world and this generation. And it's because we haven't really listened to them. We haven't, there's a whole bunch of stuff for why that is. But that's what that letter is opening up for me. It's opening something like that up for me. And right now, it's so funny in my life, you know, I feel I'm an accomplished artist. You know, I don't have any, you know, I feel okay as an intellectual. It's not like I have to, I don't want to prove myself on those fronts anymore. What I do love, though, is supporting this generation. I love supporting these younger generations into their voices, connecting with their power. And I'm not a youth worker. I don't know what it is. It's evolving right now, but I know that I want to support them. I want to support, or I want to support those who are directly supporting them.
To just keep teaching you. That's helpful. And on the layer of just a mom who wants, her son wants his mom to validate him.
Yes.
Validate his pain.
Yes.
It's so simple. But we, as parents, it's way harder.
It is.
We want to fix it. We want to tell them, no, that's not how it is.
No, well, yeah. And he was like, I was like, what do you think of my response? He's like, like, okay.
But the courage it took for him to write that and put that into words, I mean.
And he let me publish it.
Remarkable. Thank him.
I do. I tell him.
Thank you.
I don't think
he doesn't know the ripple.
No. Mm-hmm. He doesn't know the ripple. Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter. Matters.
And at some point when our relationship is, stronger, and it is getting there between me and him, I would love for him to, I'd love to do a little program called, I'm making this up in the moment, called like Dialogue on Race, Mother and Son, you know. Yeah. We got 30, 35 years separating us in perspective, gender, you know, all kinds of things. We look at things differently. I mean, we're both political. We're both very progressive, but we also look at things very differently.
Interesting. That's so fascinating. So I had to get to this. When you and I first spoke, abundance was a big theme in our first conversation, and that really stayed with me because you have this fierce countercultural devotion to abundance, and you and your husband are living and making a living as artists and entrepreneurs and teachers and writers and musicians. And it gets back to our talk of being an artist and needing space to be and not space to hustle. And then needing space to let it breathe and nurture and grow and not do again. Very countercultural. It's really swimming upstream.
Yeah.
And that's lonely. It's lonely. So, because you don't have And we don't, I don't think about how isolating it can feel when you're, when I'm swimming upstream. And you think, I just, you know, I need to do this, but without that support. So I guess I want to talk about that energy, the cost, the benefits. What's your edge of that right now? Abundance seems like a big theme in your life. So how is that? How would you today, in this moment, respond to all of that?
Well, what I'm aware of in this moment is how, because I grew up, my earliest memories are memories of neglect, of not having enough, of being literally hungry. By the time we went to foster care, we were like underweight. So we were wearing, you know, double layer clothes just to try to fill in our little kid clothes, you know, so we wouldn't look, you know, so bad. So I'm like, wow, no wonder I have a real concern about abundance. I mean, it's in there. It's in my nervous system. Just in there early, the not having enough, and then the coming into having more than enough. I'm into foster care. I'm into more than enough, you know, because it's all relative, right? Because I never worried about a meal once I moved into foster care, you know? But nonetheless, that not having enough, that hustle mentality was still with me. Like, I was always looking at ways, oh man, like, if I put a quarter in that newspaper thing, but I took out 5 newspapers, I could sell them and I can make $1.25. See what I'm saying? This is the hustle mindset. And there's a few aspects of this. So one is, it's incredibly great in the sense of the hustle mindset is like active. Okay, I have a problem with being a victim. You might have noticed. So I'm like, you know, so I kind of have an proactive hustle mindset. And that's been very good for me as an entrepreneur. Very good for me. As an artist, which is another word for entrepreneur, very good for me, right? On the one hand. But on the other hand, it's also detrimental, because then the capacity to be receptive, to relax, to trust is another capacity, another set of skills. And that is much more unfamiliar to my nervous system. So when I talk about right now, my theme for the year is abundance of love and abundance of finances. It's like believing counterculturally that there's more than enough for all of us. And I don't have to fight for every scrap. I can relax and still receive. And that's like a, what the hell is that? What is that? Is that a mindset? Is that a faith? It's a way to proceed. It's a way to proceed. It's a choice. It's a way to proceed and to perceive what's coming in here. The other piece I want to say about having grown up without enough is the feeling of, is it okay for me to have more than enough? Is it really okay for me to have more than enough? And is it okay for me to have more than enough and to let other people know? Mm-hmm. You know? Is this abundance something that I need to keep secret, you know, because it means that I've done something bad if I have more than enough? Because in one of my interpretations of good and bad, you know, powerful and good is over here and powerful is over here, is that the underdog doesn't have enough. And it's the bad guys who have more than enough, and they're screwing over everybody else, the underdog. So if I have more than enough, then am I no longer a good guy? You know? and am I aligned with the bad guys? Mm-hmm. You know? And like I said, I love my mom. I mean, my identification was with my mom. So, so claiming my, you know, birthright to more than enough, it also feels like, wow, that's a stretch. That it's legit for me to have more than enough. And that I haven't left her, you know, by having more than enough. I haven't forgotten her. And as I'm saying this out loud, remember I said earlier, strengthen the mother? So one of the things I've gotten interested in is people who come from not having enough, who are interested in strengthening other folks. Understanding that there is a systemic context of oppression, of exploitation, you know. So one of the struggles I really have is keeping in mind that context and individual power in the midst of a systemic and unequal and exploitive system, capitalism, right? And here's something that I think is true. I don't just think it. At some level, it is true for me without thinking about it. I value that which I pay more for. When I give more of my resources to something, I value it. There's a value associated with it. And when you ask me to pay more for something and I choose to pay more for that thing, then I'm coming at it with another an energy that I'm not coming at it when you said, this is for you and it's for free and come when you like and don't come when you don't like, you know, like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's space for all of that in the world. But I am getting more and more comfortable with my gifts being super valuable. Mm-hmm. And so some stuff I just give out very freely. Like I always want to do that, you know. But then some stuff is super valuable. And for you to get that, you got to bring something. You know what I mean? Because there's some real, not just expertise and labor, but there's something else there.
There's a cost.
Yes. There's a cost to me. There's an investment I'm making in you.
Yes. Yeah, investment.
And you know, if you're a teacher, you don't ever want to spend more time grading a paper than the person who wrote the paper put into it. Because then I'm like, what the hell? That does not make sense. And I have felt that way sometimes. I'm like, the time I'm putting in, figuring out how you could have structured this, and I, you know, when you just put this thing out there. No. No.
The ancestors. So when you write, you know, it's a very visceral, very mystical conversation you're in with them. In your dreams and your imagination and your writing, and it feels like you're really in conversation with them and talking to you, it feels like they're here with us. So I wonder what that, talk about that. What is that connection and why does it matter so much?
Well, the most immediate ancestor presence for me is my mom and my grandmother, my mom's mother, very immediate. If I'm gonna call on somebody, I'm right there. Cause I know that they totally love me and they have my back. And they have it to the extent of their wisdom. Meaning they have it to the extent of their capacity as ancestors in whatever realm they're in right now. And then there's this thing of, oh my God, this inheritance of the ancestors in this country. So like claiming, you know, Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, claiming, you know, the incredibly crazy, cruel, you know, demonic folks who created all kinds of cruelty and horror to other human beings as part of my inheritance, as well as to the people who, with incredible grace, you know, created a whole spiritual path of transcendence. You know what I'm talking about? I mean, like, I feel like the challenge is to embrace all of my ancestry. And when the piece that we toured for 4 years, the piece that my theater company formed around, there was a poem. And the piece of the poem that I started telling people about was, you know the ancestors are calling you. You know the ancestors are calling you. They say, forgive me. They say, I forgive you. And I felt like that was not my, that came through me, it was a message, you know? And that web of forgive, of extending forgiveness is countercultural. And I forgive you, like I already forgive you, you know? I mean, that's, you call that grace, you know? On a overall, overview kind of level, that's how I look at, so I got my mom and my grandma, and I've got this knowing that there's a web of forgiveness, and we can just relax. We can relax, you know?
To learn more about Dr. Amanda Kemp, to order her book, watch her TED Talk, see her performance schedule, or participate in one of her racial justice and mindfulness mastermind classes, go to www.dramandakemp.com. And please drop us a note on our website, 3MinuteStoryteller.com, to recommend a storyteller to us, or just to let us know what Amanda's words evoked for you. And while you're there, please subscribe to our email list so you never miss a story from us. Thanks for listening.